Welcome to our paranormal afterlife. This is our paranormal afterlife, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. And you can enjoy the extended version of this episode ad-free, along with over 100 hours of extended episodes on Patreon. This week, I'm talking to Richard Martini about his book, She Was Never Lost, The Amelia Earhart Saga. This book is based on 30 years of research, including Richard connecting to Amelia Earhart through mediums 16 times. Writer, director, author Richard is an award-winning filmmaker who has written and or directed 9 theatrical features and a number of documentaries. His first book, Flipside, A Tourist's Guide on How to Navigate the Afterlife, went to number one twice at Amazon in all its genres. Well, hi, Richard. Thanks a lot for coming back to the podcast.
I am so thrilled to be here with you, Simon. And can I say that when this new book came out, you're the first person I thought of. And I did go on coast to coast and talk to them about it.
Yeah.
They got a huge audience. But still, that being said, I thought about you because we do have the most unusual conversations. You know we do. And for the audience that's tuning in now for the first time or the last time, one of our conversations that Simon and I did, we did a guided meditation live on the air. And it was fascinating because of what Simon could become aware of, communicating with beings off stage, let's say, or off planet, who could talk about the journey. But, this book, this latest book, it's called She Was Never Lost. It's about Amelia Earhart, or I call it the Amelia Earhart Saga, because story just didn't seem to make sense for me, because it's really such an in-depth thing. And you're talking to somebody who, back in 1988, got a letter from his girlfriend, old girlfriend from high school, and said, why hasn't anybody made a movie about her? And I looked it up back in the days when you had to look stuff up. And it turned out there had only been one film. RKO Pictures had made a movie based on, these ham radio operators who heard her after she crashed, supposedly.
Could you just say, for the listeners that don't know, who was she? What did she do?
So Amelia Earhart, and it's weird that she's in the news, and this is also kind of thrilling because something happened last week, or maybe 2 weeks ago, but something happened that was so extraordinarily unusual, even for me, who writes about the flip side, writes about the afterlife, writes about talking to people no longer on the planet, that I'm thrilled to be able to share it with your listeners. And I sent you a link to a clip. You can put it on your site if you want.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. But Amelia Earhart, in a nutshell, she was a young girl growing up in Kansas who, when she was in her early teens, got a chance to fly on somebody took her up like a stuntman. And she knew instantly that's what she wanted to do with her life. And so she became one of the first female pilots. I think she's number 16 who got a license to fly. And a number of things happened in her life. Her dad was incarcerated for being an alcoholic. And I think he might have been abusive. I don't know. But people in those days didn't generally go to prison for alcohol, but he did. And that made her family move away from Kansas. And then eventually she reconnected with him out in California, out in Santa Monica, where I live, where she got her license. And then she wound up becoming a care worker in Boston at an orphanage with immigrant children. And so, and when she could, she would go out and fly. But what happened was a wealthy woman from America, Lady Guest is her name, who wanted to be a pilot herself, decided she wanted to sponsor a contest. So the first female pilot to cross the Atlantic would get $10,000. Back in those days, that was a lot of money. And so these two guys came up with an idea. She's not asking for the woman to fly the plane. She's just asking for the first female pilot to be in the plane. Came up with that idea. And so they went out and hired two pilots and basically and convinced this woman who was going to fly herself. She was going to do it herself, raise the money for it. They convinced her not to do that. And they were looking through a photo album and they saw this photograph of Amelia from her flight, you know, the pass that she got. And she looked a lot like Charles Lindbergh. And one of the two guys was the nephew of the guy who published the Lindbergh books, huge bestsellers. And so they came up with this idea, like, we'll hire somebody, we'll fly her in the back of the plane across the Atlantic, which is what they did.
Did they say that she was the pilot? Did they lie about it?
No. No, but, you know, people are weird. People in those days, of course, you know, women stayed in the kitchen. So she was advertised as the first female pilot to cross the Atlantic. That sentence is accurate, okay? But she sat in the back of the plane like a sack of potatoes, as she put it. And so when she landed in Wales, they made a big deal out of it. And she told everyone who would listen, I didn't fly the plane. These other two guys did. They're the heroes. And they would go, yeah, yeah, yeah. What were you, you know, what were you thinking about? What were you wearing? And, you know, what was your, what'd you have for lunch? And then they took her back and she had a ticker tape parade in New York City. And even then, while she got the, you know, the key to the city of New York, she said, I don't deserve this, but, you know, I on behalf of women everywhere. And so this was her thing in life, which was to show that women could do anything that men could do. Okay. And so she then was the guy who helped do the flight, George Putnam, was married to a crayon heiress. Her family was very wealthy, and they lived in Rye, New York. And so he put Amelia in a back room in the house, like in a house behind the house, to help her write the book. It was called 20 Hours or 40 Minutes. And that was a bestseller. But during that time, they started a relationship. And according to somebody that interviewed the wife, who George Putnam's wife, Dorothy, she walked in on George and Amelia in bed together, but with another woman. And so that was a big, but she didn't tell anybody. She told this reporter years later, but it was like this hidden secret, let's say. So her life was about secrets in many ways, things that people don't know about. But she decided all those accolades she got, she needed to earn them. So 5 years after Lindbergh went, she flew solo across the Atlantic. It's important to point out that even though she flew solo, she didn't get where she was going. She was supposed to go to Paris, but she got to Ireland. And apparently the plane had a lot of things wrong with it, and the instruments all went out, and they froze up, and it was a terrible flight. But ultimately, she brought the plane down in a pasture in Ireland. And so, again, people weren't paying attention to the fact that she was off course. They were like, she was the first woman to do it solo. And they had another ticker tape parade, and which she deserved. And then George Putnam and her did this thing of she would enter these contests and then she would fly and all across the country. Now, it has come out since then that quite a few of the mechanics that were hired by George Putnam were pilots, women pilots who went with her and made sure that she was doing everything correctly. So some of them have come out out of the woodwork over the years and said, you know, she wasn't really a good pilot. But truthfully, she eventually did become a great pilot. And people who flew with her later in life said she was an amazing pilot. So then she would do these feats and then they would write a book. And that's how they made money, her and Putnam. Anyway, and that's why Putnam has the knock on him like he was some kind of a carnival barker and forcing her into these things. But they were a team. And if you look at her letters that she wrote to Putnam and Putnam wrote to her, they're all at the Purdue Library and the Harvard Library. I've seen them all. there's a lot of intimacy there in terms of their friendship. They were great buddies. They really liked each other. They had the same sense of humor, et cetera, et cetera. Even though she preferred women because the third person in bed with her was her girlfriend. I suspected that. And her story was that in 1937, she decided to do an around-the-world flight. And it was, she had flown to Hawaii, and then the plane ground looped, which means it like she had a crash. And they had to fix the plane. At the time, they didn't have the money. I think it was something like they needed $37,000, which was like $700,000. They just didn't have the money. So she wrote to FDR, who she had met and was friends with, and said, can you help us? And he wrote a note to the Navy Department and said, get involved, help her. And so the Navy Department, U.S. Navy, again, 1937, the winds of war were happening. They said, we'll sponsor the flight, we'll fix the plane, but you're going to take our, the route that we devised for you. You're not going to go Oakland and that way, east or west, sorry, but you're going to go east. So she was going to leave from Florida. So they changed her flight plan. They hired people to come in and refit her plane. And it's been misreported for many years. And the book reveals that the person who refit her plane was the guy who created the CIA Skunk Works. He's the most famous engineer in the history of spy planes. He created the SR-71 and U-2 plane and all these other things. I wasn't aware of that until Amelia pointed it out to me during a session with her that this passage in a book was really important. And when I looked into the passage, I realized the author had gotten the name of this person wrong. And when I found out who it really was, I discovered, it's in the book, that the person who refit her plane was at the beginning of his career of as a spy master of flight. So, but what he did was he made it so her gas tanks lasted longer. So she had more gas. And over the years, when she disappeared, quote unquote, so in 1937 and July 2nd, she took off from Ley, New Guinea, was never, quote, heard from again. They had a air-sea rescue operation, the largest in history. FDR sent everyone there. But while they were flying over all the Japanese islands, the Japanese mandated islands, they were recording and filming the deepwater ports they were building for war. That was something the Japanese had been trying to stop people from doing. And they had incarcerated what they called spies. And there's a long record of that. You know, people who would sail through the Marshall Islands would be arrested. They'd be, you know, their stuff confiscated, which I mentioned in the book. Ultimately, the official story is that she crashed at sea. You know, that she was lost on the way to Howland Island and she went into the drink. And there's a whole group of people who believe, and they're dedicated researchers who believe that she went to this island she was supposed to go to as the B plan, which is called Nikumaroro, Gardner Island in those days. She was supposed to go there. And they've been looking there for the past 30 years, you know, digging up, you know, the claiming that she was a deserted isle and that's where she went. However, in my research for the past over 30 years, I've either interviewed people directly or I've interviewed people who interviewed people directly who saw her land the plane on Milia Atoll, saw her arrested by the Japanese, saw her slapped in the face by the Japanese, saw her and the plane put aboard a Japanese ship, saw that ship taken to a nearby island, interviewed with a doctor, young doctor, who went aboard and treated her wounds and treated the navigator Fred Noonan's wounds. Numerous people I've interviewed on Saipan who saw her come ashore the day that she was brought ashore in 1937, saw her in the hospital, treated her, took care of her, washed her clothes, fed her in prison, as well as interviewing people who saw her paraded around the island in 1944 with two other American pilots who had been shot down. Those two pilots are a matter of record. What's not a matter of record is the fact that she was on the truck that was taken around the island. And I've interviewed Saipanese people who said I saw her. And one guy said to me, look, it's not something you'd forget. Here's the first Caucasian woman you've ever seen in your life. She's dressed in cat like a man, and her hands are tied. Well, how would you forget that? Plus, you know, hearing her speak her native tongue. So the point is, there's plenty of evidence that she was on Saipan. And like I say, I've interviewed at least 15 eyewitnesses who placed her there. But there were 200 eyewitnesses who saw her there that were written about by Fred Gerner. And the point is, there is no other island on the planet where people claim to have seen her. None. There's all kinds of theories about, you know, there was an engine here or a plane there. But these are eyewitnesses, and I don't really understand why Caucasians can't hear an island witness who doesn't speak English the same way that they do and not hear them. You know, they look for the mistakes that they're making in syntax. You know, I saw a European woman. That's what they call Caucasians, Europeans. So when somebody, an English-speaking person, sees that, they go, well, they're not even talking about Amelia Earhart because she was an American. You see, aside from the fact that there's Central America, South America, North America, you know, Americans don't even know their own country.
When they refit the plane, they fitted it with spy cameras, didn't they? Reconnaissance cameras.
Well, from what I can tell, and apologies, I have a cat that's, from what I can tell, yes, I interviewed the son of a mechanic who was a Navy officer, not officer, he was a Navy workman, who claimed that he was one of the people who installed the cameras. And the son said that his father went on to become a California Highway Patrol man and was just not prone to lying. And he said that he was there. They installed two Fairchild aerial reconnaissance cameras, which were quite bulky. So it wouldn't make a lot of sense for her to be carrying them. Plus, when she flew from New Guinea to Howland, ultimately she had to leave at night. So she couldn't have filmed anything anyway. So there are people that report that when the plane came down in Mille Atolls, they saw Fred Noonan take a box out of the plane and she and him buried it. Now, I don't know what was in that box. I have no idea. There was a guy who wrote a book about that. But that aside, even if she had spy cameras on the plane, they wouldn't have worked. She did. She is quoted as saying, imagine me being a spy. Someone who worked at Lockheed in Burbank reported that. But we don't know the context of the sentence. Could have been comedic. Could have been serious. No idea. Imagine me being a spy. In those days, 1937, being a spy was an act of war. So it was very serious if somebody caught you spying. But in terms of the details of what was found, and then it gets very interesting, aside from what happened to her, which is when I started reading about U.S. Marines who were on the island of Saipan in 1944. They arrived in June, and I interviewed quite a few Marines. But the most important was Julius Neighbors, who I read about him in a book, and I tracked him down in Baldwin, Mississippi, and I called him on the phone, and I said, what do you remember about Amelia Earhart on Saipan? He said, I remember it as if it was yesterday. So I said, hold that thought. I'm going to fly to Mississippi, and I'm going to interview you. So I went down there, spent about 3 hours with this guy, asked him, you know, his motivation for telling the story now and all these details about his life that I could corroborate. And what he told me was that in June of 1944, he and all the Marines came ashore. He talked about that was what that was like on the Higgins boat. He talked about it. And he was the code, the wire man, they called him, the guy who decoded messages that came in from headquarters. And that's the way they communicated. And so he would listen for the message, you know, the decoding machine. He talks about it. And then they would, you know, like the Enigma machine, yeah. Enigma machine in England. They would decode the messages. And he said it was June 19th, 1944, where he decoded a message that said, we have found Amelia Earhart's airplane at Oslito Airfield. Now, they'd only gotten there June 5th. So now here it is 13 days later. And then he said he was ordered by his commanding officer, Wallace, to go to the plane and guard it for 24 hours. Don't let anybody in or out. And while he was there for 24 hours, some Navy brass came and they said, they found Amelia Earhart's plane. We want to see it. And he said, nobody gets in. Orders is orders. Apparently, he pulled out a sidearm in the middle of a war. But what's interesting about that story is somebody else overheard it. And I interviewed that guy who was there and overheard this Marine with his pistol out saying, orders is orders. You're not getting in there to see Amelia Earhart's airplane. He also then decoded the message and said, we're going to fly the plane. And so they took it up for a test flight, see if it flew. And over a dozen U.S. Marines saw it. As one Marine said to me, she only was missing for 7 years. It's the most famous plane on the planet. It's not like you wouldn't recognize it. And then he decoded the message, Julius Nabors, a couple of weeks after that. He wasn't sure about the date. And it said, we're going to destroy Amelia Earhart's airplane at Zeo Airfield at such and such time.
Why didn't they tell the press and say, hey, this is fantastic news?
Okay, but let's start with the facts. What are the facts? We don't know why. We can conjecture, but we're dealing with details. So he got one of his fellow Marines, they got in a Jeep, and they drove out to the airfield, and they went to this bunker that's behind one of the old hangar or one of the Japanese headquarters, and sat in the bushes and watched as U.S. forces poured gasoline or jet fuel, there were no jets, plane fuel on the plane. And then a P-38, as he said, flew up and started firing and hit the plane and made it explode into flames. Again, your brain goes, why would anybody do that? However, Tom Devine, somebody else I interviewed, was walking by the hangar at that point, heard the P-38, heard the firing, came around and saw it on fire. And he says he had seen it earlier because he had also heard, he was there when Nabors heard, said orders is orders. So, and Tom gathered over a dozen Marines who saw it burning, who saw the plane burning, saw the electric burning. I interviewed a U.S. Marine who was on the airfield, and he said he didn't see it, but the guys they was with all said, hey, did you see the Electra? It was sitting there on the airfield. So people saw it burn, which goes to the heart of her story. Why would you burn Amelia Earhart's airplane? Because in the middle of a war, it wasn't important. She wasn't important. She was expendable. If you had to stop your war to explain how her plane got there, it's annoying. FDR, in the research I've heard, as well as talking to the flip side, was not aware of the plane being on Saipan or finding it. So the order came from men aboard the U.S. Admiral Nimitz's ship, which my grandfather, by the way, who was in the Office of Naval Intelligence, was there on that ship in July of 1944. So this is probably why I've been obsessed with telling this story. It's like my grandfather has been nudging me all this time to tell her story.
I was just going to suggest maybe they wanted to hide the fact they'd put spy cameras on the plane.
Well, I think it's more about the enigma. So why is it that Churchill allowed them to kill innocent Brits during World War II when he knew they had broken the codes, they knew where the Germans were going to attack? Why didn't he warn people?
Yeah, they didn't want the Germans to know they could break their code.
They had broken their code, and the Americans had broken the Japanese code in the early 1930s. That's public record. So if you knew that she was on Saipan, the Japanese would know that you had broken their codes. if you now made a, some kind of a statement about her, and at the time, because nobody could fathom how it happened that she, her plane was in a hangar. Did she land it there? Was she a spy for the Japanese? Was she Tokyo Rose? There were people who thought that, you know, that this a woman speak. It's all nonsense. And my point of the book, she was never lost. She knew who she was. She knew where she was. She knew what happened. All you got to do is ask her. And so that leads us to the woo-woo part of this book, which is somewhere about 2008, I was working on the film. I mean, I told you, 1988. Friend of mine said, "Why, you know, let's do this script." So we wrote a script together. I took it to my agent, and that Monday, I gave it to her on Friday. Monday, she said, "Diane Keaton's making your screenplay." I was like, "Wow, that was fast." I hadn't even checked it for typos, which was probably a mistake, because by Friday, Diane Keaton had hired another writer to write that story. And so I was kicked to the curb, as they say. And so they made that film without me. But then, you know, because we had the same attorney, they made sure they gave me a credit historian because they used a couple of my scenes within the story. But that being said, I can't really blame Diane Keaton for that. I mean, just whatever. She wanted a woman to write that story. And so, but it also challenged me because if now it meant that I had to go back to work and find out all these details. So over the years, I wrote a screenplay. And at some point, after I made a film in 1996, we were in Cannes. Rebecca Bussard starred in that film, Point of Betrayal, with Rod Taylor. Rebecca looks uncannily like Amelia Earhart. I didn't even notice it until a French journalist said to me, "Are you guys making a movie about Amelia Earhart?" She had just dyed her hair red. It was uncanny. I mean, really looked just like her. And so I said, "Well, that's our next movie." And so we focused on that. And Philip Noyce, the film director, became our producer. And we took it around. We took it to HBO. We took it to Polygram. And I wanted to use footage of Amelia Earhart, the real Amelia Earhart, and blend it with footage of Rebecca Bussard. And in you know, CGI today could do that, you know, easily. But in those days, it was probably more difficult, and they just didn't want to go with a non-star, as they put it. And so that died on the runway. But ultimately, it kept pulling me back. And then Philip called me up. He said, "Hey, I'm making a movie with Hilary Swank about Amelia Earhart. Can I have all your research?" And I said, "No, but you can lease it from me." And so I built a website. So all of the stories of her life, I don't know, 5,000 photographs, 30 hours of footage that I had researched, I put it in one place online so that people could access it. Hilary Swank, when she worked on the film, every day of Amelia's life where she was photographed was there. So she could look at what she was wearing, how she talked, what she sounded like, et cetera, et cetera. It was a useful tool. But Philip left that movie. Amira Nair took it over. And I was told she'd didn't use a computer, so it was of no value to her, this research. Ultimately, I went on to work with Philip on the movie Salt with Angelina Jolie, and so I did the same thing for him there with the CIA story, et cetera, et cetera. But because the studio, Fox, had hired me to do this research, it allowed me to do so much more and get really obscure titles and books and interviews and with eyewitness reports, and to sort of follow the story of what happened. And then I ran into, then I get a call from, I made a documentary, it's on Amazon, about Earhart's Electra. And I got a call from a U.S. Marine explorer, Mike Harris, who had made a couple of documentaries in that region. And he had filmed a number of eyewitnesses. And he said, "Why don't we go over there and find her?" So this is in 2013. I flew over with Mike, a guy named Paul Cooper, Southwest Airlines pilot. And the three of us spent a couple of months exploring and talking to people who saw her. Saipanese people won't say, "Oh, I saw Amelia Earhart." they will say the opposite if you ask them, until you ask them about their life and their journey. What was it like during the war? And once they talk about their life, they will then say, oh, well, my mother was working in the hospital and she treated this woman pilot for these wounds and they called her Amelia. It's like he's not saying it was. He's saying that's what she told him. And she also told him, don't tell anybody because you'll be executed. Japanese had a very civil relationship with the people of Saipan until 1937, when the soldiers from the Manchurian War came there and suddenly they were executing people for not bowing low enough. It totally changed. When you hear the Saipanese story, their side of the story, you can hear these stories about what their experience was like.
Hi, this is Simon. Do you have a fascination with reincarnation? And would you like to know about your past lives? I have a diploma in clinical hypnotherapy, and I conduct past life regression sessions over Zoom. If you'd like to find out how a session works for you, you can book a free 20-minute consultation on my website. That's at pastliveshypnosis.co.uk. The link is in the show notes.
So I'm in New York working on the movie Salt with Philip Noyce. Friend of mine calls me up. She says, hey, I have this friend of mine, Patty Canova. She's a medium. She wrote her life story as a HBO miniseries kind of thing. Would you read it? I said, yeah, sure. So I gave her some notes, which she appreciated. And then Patty said, I'd like to read you. And I said, why? You know, I'm not interested. I don't even know what that means. And she said, no, I do care tarot readings. I was like, no thanks. Not my cup of tea. And, you know, Patty, New Yorker, tough. They don't take no for an answer. She whips up a deck of regular playing cards and puts them in front of me. It says, turn them over. Okay. And beep, boop, boop. She looks at me and says, you're writing a movie about a female pilot. Is it Amelia Earhart? And I look at my friend like, is this a joke? What is this? And then she proceeded to tell me things about Amelia that I was curious about. And we did a series of interviews. It was shocking to me because, as it is in the book, there's a transcript of all of what she said and all of the stuff that she said then, 2000 and I think it was 8. You know, what turned out to be accurate. And then I ran into Dr. Elisa Medus, who had just written a book about her son who had passed away, and called her on the phone, on her cell phone. Mom, I'm okay. And she created a website called Channeling Eric. And they were interviewing people on the flip side. And I casually said, you should interview Amelia Earhart. And she said, we're interviewing her on Tuesday. And so I went, can I see the questions? And she said, sure. So she sent me the usual Wikipedia questions, you know, lost at sea, blah, blah, blah. I said, can I help? Sure. So I crafted the questions. And they're all about Amelia. Like, for example, who was the love of your life and was it a painter? Now, that's a question that nobody would think to ask. But if you already know that the love of her life was a Dutch painter who was a woman, it's a different way to ask that question. In the interview, which you can find on my page, Hacking the Afterlife podcast on YouTube, you can find this interview, Jamie Butler, with Amelia, where she says, Amelia is saying she doesn't want to change the official record of her journey at this moment in time. However, yes, it was a woman and it was a painter and she was Dutch. Now, I got to tell you, it took me a long time to figure out the identity of that painter. It wasn't until years later, and it's in the book. But then, so now I'm in L.A. and I'm writing I'd written Flipside and that came out. And now it's the book, It's a Wonderful Afterlife, comes out. I get a call from a medium, Jennifer Schaefer in Los Angeles. And she says, I love your work. Why don't we talk? What about? I'm like, what do you do? She said, I'm a medium. I said, oh, again, you know, I don't really get that. And I said, she goes, well, I work on missing person cases. Ding. So I realized, I said to her, how'd you like to work on a missing person case with me? And she said, I'm in. So I took my cameras over to her office, testing her, let's say, ostensibly, for 3 hours. I interviewed someone who knew as much about Amelia as I did. and I was aware that I knew more than most. And during the course of that interview, Jennifer, I'd just come back from Saipan. Jennifer drew a map of Saipan, drew a location where her body was moved after she died. It was originally buried somewhere, and then it was moved by Catholic nuns to a more appropriate burial site. She also drew a map of where the plane, after it was burned, was pushed off the runway and planted. And these were two locations I had already been to. I literally stood exactly where she was drawing a map. I mean, she'd never been to Saipan. She didn't know where it was. But here she was drawing an accurate map of the road that goes around Chalankanoa and et cetera. So when that sort of thing, and also, by the way, at the very end of the interview, I was asking Amelia, so how did you die? And she said, dysentery. And I thought, I said, well, I heard that you were shot or you were beheaded. Are you just not telling me the truth because you're afraid that I'm going to be upset? Jennifer's answer to that was, oh, and the two GIs who dug her up only found an arm. Now, I knew that in 1965, Fred Gerner had interviewed these two GIs who claimed that they had dug her up and that they dug her, the bodies of her and Fred Noonan up and turned that over to the U.S. military. And for all these years, people are like, well, what happened to the bodies? But here's Amelia saying, well, when they dug me up, they only found an arm. When I left the interview, my head was swimming. Is it possible that I've just had an interview with Amelia Earhart? The phone rang. It was a Seattle-based flight guy who has testified with the NTSB before Congress about, you know, plane crashes. He's an expert. He said to me, Rich, I just spent 5 hours looking at top secret documents that this investigator has gathered. And everything you told me about Earhart is true. It's in his documents. However, when they dug her up, they only found an arm. Literally heard that from Amelia 5 minutes earlier. And by the way, I talked to that investigator sometime later, and I said that to him, and he said, I don't remember that in the report. I don't remember seeing that. I'm like, well, it doesn't matter whether you remember it. What matters is that the guy, you know, 10 minutes later said it to me. Anyway, and subsequently, I was able to find, because I do my research, that in 1977, these two guys who were interviewed by the Chicago Tribune said that when they dug her up, they only found a partial rib cage and an arm. So then my question then became to Amelia, so where's the rest of you? And that's when I got these answers. These Catholic nuns who had taken care of her, when the Japanese dumped her in a pit, they thought that was inappropriate. Christian, even though Amelia wasn't very religious. And so they moved her to the closer to the Catholic church that's there. And here we are. And now here's what's interesting. And, you know, not that all of it's not interesting. But so I finished the book. And, you know, I was out there talking about it. And I don't know why. You know, maybe it's how algorithms work. Maybe it's reading your email. I don't know. But Google sends me a link to a YouTube video that was filmed by the U.S. Marines on Saipan called The Liberation of the Aslito Airfield. So I click on it, and I realize the clapboard says June 18th, 1944. It's funny because the guy misspelled Saipan. Siapan. But I just finished the book and I knew what Julius Neighbors had said. On June 19th, 1944, I decoded the message that said we have found Amelia Earhart's airplane. So this was the day before. So that means nobody filming would have known that her plane was there on the airfield. So now I'm watching as the camera goes all throughout the field. There's only two hangars still standing. One's a big, huge hangar that had a lot of material and boxes inside. And the other one's a smaller hangar that had three airplanes inside. Cameraman sets, and this footage is pristine. Somebody had totally cleaned it up. puts the camera on a tripod, and he pans on the inside of the hangar. I'm looking like a hawk. Is it possible there's something in this hangar that we haven't seen before? I've seen this footage before. I never thought about it. Clearly, there's two zeros, Mitsubishi zeros, because the front of the plane was uncovered. So like whoever would, they'd gone in there and taken off the cover, and there were these two zeros. You could see it, you know, the engine, the propeller. It pans across, and there's a third plane, but it's not parked the same way as the zeros. And that's when my brain said, why is that plane not parked like the other two? And then I could see it's because it was longer. So they parked it sideways so it would fit in the hangar. Otherwise, if they parked it forward, it would be sticking out. So they parked it sideways. Then I looked up the height, wingspan, length of the zero, 10 feet high, wingspan 39 feet. The Electra, 10 feet high, wingspan 39 feet. The length of the zero is 39 feet, but the length of the Electra is 55 feet. So it's much longer, 16 feet longer. And now I've seen thousands of photographs of this plane. And when I slowed the footage down, cleaned it up, cleared it up, lightened it up, boom, it's there under camouflage. I can see the exact silhouette of the same silhouette of the same dang plane that I've seen 1,000 times. I found Amelia Earhart's airplane in the footage the Marines took on June 18th, 1944. And that, where did that come from? You see, who sent that to me? And then when I realized that, you know, here we have this evidence. Oh, plus, it's not only Erskine Neighbors, because a number of other GIs that I interviewed were there on Saipan, and they were told, hey, they found Amelia Earhart's airplane in a hangar down on the strip. And then they got in the Jeep and drove down and saw it. Now, think about this for half a second, which is U.S. Marines finds a plane, they uncover it, and they're like, oh, my gosh, they're not going to move it unless they're told to move it. They're not going to move it to another hangar or drag it around the airfield. They report it like a good Marine would. And it took them the next day. They said, hey, we found the plane, and now this Marine goes down there to guard it. And so he's watching it for 24 more hours. Imagine. That's an entire day. You're standing in front of that plane. It's not like you don't know what it is. They've told you what it is. And you're stopping people who are coming up and saying, hey, then I'm interviewing, I was flying home to Chicago and I was sitting next to a veteran of Saipan. And I said, hey, let me ask you a goofy question. Do you ever hear anything about Amelia Earhart at Saipan? He was like, now that you mention it, when I was shot in the first wave, I was in hospital there and they were all talking about it, that they had found her plane on Oslito Airfield. So it's not just me. It's me pointing out there are dozens of people who saw the plane who can tell you that it was the plane. It's only the fact that we as humans tend to disbelieve everything that's not the official record, which is insanity. So her plane was on Saipan. They found it. They took it out. They destroyed it. Why? Because it was in the way. They were in the middle of fighting a battle. Don't forget June 6th, what was happening in Europe. D-Day. And here it was June 18th in Saipan. What are we going to do about this plane? Are we going to explain how it got there? We don't know. Are we going to let the Japanese know we broke their codes? No. Get rid of it.
How much information have you got with Jennifer going to ask Amelia Earhart stuff? How much has she been giving you from the other side?
Well, let's just do the timeline. So, you know, I don't meet Jennifer until 2013, and that's when she's drawing. I just came back from Saipan 2 weeks earlier, and she's drawing this map of Saipan, and she's talking about Amelia being, she didn't know anything about Amelia Earhart at all. And she's saying, you know, her plane, she brought the plane down. Is that true? Did she land the plane? And then, you know, she's arrested. Oh, okay. I'm seeing her. She's in prison. And, you know, all these things, all these details. Of course, I was curious about her love life. I'm curious about all the secrets in her life. And so over the course of the next, how many years are we now? Since 13, 12 years. And if you look at our podcast and you search Amelia, there's 60 different interviews with Amelia Earhart. 60. Where Jennifer and I, for example, when we were doing an interview and Amelia comes forward and I said, you know, Amelia, I'm having a real hard time figuring out who this Dutch painter is, because I've looked at all the Dutch women painters of throughout history. And I've looked at, you know, I was one of my major in college, you know, was art history. And so I know where to look. And I can't find her. And Jennifer says, Amelia says, go to GPT chat and ask, which is hilarious because, you know, is Amelia getting that wrong or is that Jennifer getting that wrong? I don't know, but it doesn't matter. So I do. I go to ChatGPT and I say, I'm looking for a Dutch artist who would have been in New York City somewhere between 1926 and 1930, which is apparently when they met. And one name comes up. Charlie Torup. And so then I think, oh, well, that's a weird coincidence. I mean, you know, has Charlie Torup ever? And at first, I can't find any evidence of Charlie Torup being in America because, you know, every time you do an art show, they know where your paintings go. But then I find it. I actually went to DeepSeek, another AI, and DeepSeek showed me that in 1927, she had an art show at the Brooklyn Academy, the Brooklyn Museum in New York City. And she toured with that all the way up to Boston. And then I started looking through all the portraits that Charlie had done from that point forward. Lo and behold, and you see it in the book, there is a portrait of Amelia Earhart. And it doesn't call her Amelia. It just says portrait of a woman. Clearly it's her. And I mean, down to the nth detail, as much as Rebecca Broussard looks like her, Charlie Cash her perfectly. And I then go back to the podcast the next week. And before I can speak, I start to say, my question is going to be, so I was doing some research. Jennifer says, you found her. I said, what? She said, they're saying, they're cheering. You found her. You found Amelia's girlfriend. Is that correct? Is that what you're going to ask me? I said, yes. That was just what I was going to ask you. It's those kinds of underlining that I've been doing for the past, I don't know how, 15 years, that you start to just, instead of, you know, trying to pretzel logic, how could Jennifer, I didn't post that. How could she know that this is what I was going to ask her? And it's Amelia saying, you got it correct. And so now I've interviewed Charlie Torup on the flip side. And she was married. She had kids. She had a family. But she was openly bi. And her family was from her British side, was very wealthy. And it wasn't an issue. It was like, to Americans, it's an issue. To her, it was her family. And her father was a military guy. Her grandfather, they didn't care. So weren't interested in it. And then she met up with her again in Paris after the trip across, after that trip in 1932. And she spent 3 or 4 weeks with George Putnam, who was, I think, still her boyfriend then. They might have been married. I forget. Anyway, but they're in Paris together. And that's where they met up again. Because I'm asking, where did you guys meet up? And Jennifer, you know, saying Paris and showing me like where they're going, what they did. And they went to a chalet and et cetera. So it's not like a love affair that's happening every week. But the real underlying truth, if you want to underline it, just go to purdue.edu and read her poetry. Amelia's poetry, it's in the book. I reproduced it in the book. Her love poems are clearly written for a woman. And when George Putnam sent the love poems to the Purdue University, he tore off the dedications, literally just ripped off, you know, who the dedicated to. And then he sometimes left out a stanza that talked about women's breasts. you know, you're feeling your, my, you know, your breast against mine, this kind of thing. He would just take that whole paragraph out because he didn't want to change the story. He had no problem with her. I mean, it's a famous prenup. She makes him sign a prenup before they get married, basically saying she's allowed to love anybody other than him and to leave at any time. And it's an amazing prenup, but it was like the first prenup in history because she got him to sign it. He asked her 6 times to marry her, and 5 times she said no. But the 6th time she went, okay, you signed this prenup saying I can leave you at any minute or be with anybody I want to be with. We won't hold each other to any kind of medieval code. And then you read her poetry where she talks about the love, this love that, and, you know, not that she only had one lover. She had others. But here's the thing that's, to me, that's important. When the way I crafted this book was partially, what was it like for Amelia to be incarcerated in a prison? I've been to that cell. I've stood in that cell that she was incarcerated in. I sat down. I've listened to what it sounds like. The sound of, you know, bugs and animals and chickens and crows and all that stuff that you hear when you're on an island. And I thought about what that was like to wake up there. And then she said that she kept a diary. And some islanders claim that she passed the diary on to them, but they lost it. So I thought, okay, if she was writing a diary, what was she saying? What was she writing about? And by the way, so now I'm doing another, so just to your question about Jennifer, I'm doing another session with Jennifer, and she says, Amelia's here, and she wants to talk about a passage in the book. And I'm thinking, is she mad? Did I screw it up? No, she loves it. It's chapter 5, paragraph 3. Jennifer, the book hasn't come out. She doesn't even know what I'm talking about. And I'm thinking, is it that specific? And so I go to chapter 5, paragraph 3. And it's the sentence where I'm talking about her last ticker tape parade was when she was driven around the island with these other 2 American pilots to be shown off to the people on Saipan. And I say, arguably, the first ticker tape parade was a charade because she didn't fly the plane. The second one, she did fly the plane, but she landed in Ireland, which she was trying to go to Paris. But the 3rd ticker tape really was just islanders looking at her as she's paraded around the island as some kind of a weird, you know, spoils of victory. She liked that.
Well, it's been great talking to you again.
Always, Simon.
I like it that you really talk and tell the story, and I can just sit back and enjoy
it. I do have a tendency to go on. You wind me up. And I just want to say again, your book, Near Death Experiences, is a fantastic book. Highly recommend it. Simon's such a terrific podcaster and interviewer. We've had so many unusual conversations. I think, what was it? Number 219, something like that. I don't know, 119. You and I had a conversation with a gray alien where we asked him questions. And at some point, Simon said, this gray alien is saying he doesn't think he's supposed to be answering these questions to you. And I did the old police lie where I said, oh, no, I already know the answer to these questions. I'm just getting you to confirm them. And then that mollified him and he continued on. I mean, that interview with the gray alien talking about how they're artificially intelligent, created by beings that we wouldn't understand, that they're here to collect genetic material to save people in other places of the universe who've lost the ability to incarnate or to procreate. And that when I asked this alien, so why do you do this? And he said, have you ever donated to the Red Cross? That was his answer to ask me. And I said, yeah. He said, these people have agreed to donate this material before they incarnated. We've known them from before, and we're collecting the information to save lives on other parts of the planet. That's a mind-bending shift in consciousness, if what he's saying is accurate.
The transcript of that conversation's in one of your books, isn't it?
Yeah. It's in Close Encounters of the Flip Side Kind, because in that book, I talk about, you know, this misnomer of what we consider aliens. And not to take away from your experience, you know, the trauma of it, which, of course, people who have had an experience like that, it's very traumatic. No question about that. But when you shift that consciousness to say, wait a minute, you're saying that I was doing that out of benevolence, selflessness, to help someone else? That's just mind-bending on so many levels. And I've heard it consistently. Whenever I have had a conversation, I do guided meditations now with people all the time. You can find me at richardmartini.com. I do it with people in all across the globe. And sometimes when I'm talking to their counsel, or they're talking to their counsel, they'll see someone who's not from Earth, who normally incarnates somewhere else. But of course, they're council members, so they're benevolent to the degree of helping. They've helped this person over all their lifetimes. So I feel very confident in asking them questions about the journey this person has taken and their role in this person's life. And sometimes I'm able to include questions about the planet that they come from and what and why they're here. And recently someone said, no one gets to come to the planet Earth without benevolence or selflessness, meaning visitors. So this thing that we do naturally of saying we have to fear what we don't understand, they're trying to say that's just not the process. It's not the way things work. And we will not be aware of what's going on until we get to a point where we realize we are them. We're not any different. We're all the same in the sense of we. Stephen Hawking was the one who told me and Jennifer, I asked him about aliens because that was the last paper that he wrote, was like Fear of Aliens. I said, have you met any? He said, Richard, all humans are aliens because they choose to incarnate from somewhere else. Wow. Okay. You know, I'm not going to argue with Stephen Hawking.
No, especially not
Well,
now.
I will if he, you know, if he gives me a contrary opinion. But anyway, that's my point. Definitely take a look at Simon's book, please.
Thanks. Thanks a lot. Well, it's great talking to you again.
Thanks. It's great talking to you. And like I said, I realized, you know, we set this appointment, and it was after we set the appointment that I realized I had found Amelia Earhart's airplane on Saipan in the footage the Marines took the day before it was found. So this is an exclusive worldwide.
Yeah. I'll put a link to that video on my Facebook group. This week, I was talking to Richard Martini about his book, She Was Never Lost, The Amelia Earhart Saga. A great way to support the podcast is to join Patreon, where you get access to the extended episodes. The Patreon episodes are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions, and you can now sign up for a 7-day free trial. You become a patron by going to patreon.com/ourparanormalafterlife, or click on the Patreon button on my homepage, pastliveshypnosis.co.uk. The links are in the show notes. And my book, titled Verified Near-Death Experiences, is out on Amazon, and you can get it on paperback, audiobook, or Kindle. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.